You please turn your cell phones off? It's always irritating when they go on. And I'm going to turn off with you. Welcome to the Humphrey Institute. I'm Larry Jacobs. I direct the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance here at the Humphrey Institute. The Center and, of course, the Institute are nonpartisan. The purpose of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance is to increase the transparency of the government process, to expand and strengthen our democracy here at home, and to look for ways to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of governance. We are engaged in a whole variety of different kinds of activities, including nonpartisan research on elections and government policy. We searched to develop, on a nonpartisan civic basis, practical solutions to pressing political and policy challenges. And we convene public forums like this one to facilitate broader discussion of important issues facing our country and our state. Today, we are pleased to be starting a new series called Connecting with Government with prominent government leaders, both in Congress and in state government. There are two main opportunities that we're hoping to take advantage of in developing this series. One is to give the opportunity to our government officials to be able to rise above the fractious debates, the talking points, to talk plainly about the substantive challenges facing our state and our country. And it's also an opportunity for students and members of our community to raise questions and to engage in dialogue with our government leaders. And in fact, there are opportunities, little cards and pencils, for you to write down questions. We'll get to them a little bit later. And there'll be people moving about to collect those. So please submit questions. We welcome that. We've also got a special feature today as part of our ongoing public forum. We're now looking into and experimenting with live blogging. So this front row here have some of our bloggers, left, right, center, and completely nonpartisan. It's been set up by the blogger of the center's Smart Politics blog, Eric Ostermeyer, who's has a law degree, has a PhD in political science, and is doing a great job. We are going to be holding these forums over the next 6 months or so with Democratic and Republican leaders. In addition to today's forum, we're going to be holding a forum with Congresswoman Betty McCollum in a week. That will also start at noon. In 10 days, on April 12th, we'll have a forum with Congressman Tim Walz. That will be at 10 a.m. in the morning. 10 a.m. this location. In late May, we'll be having a forum with Jim Ramstead on May 30th, and that will also be at noon. We're currently scheduling a number of other forums, including one with U.S. Senator Norm Coleman, and we're working on dates and scheduling that. Today, we're very honored and pleased to be inaugurating this series with Minnesota's newest U.S. Senator, Amy Klobuchar. Senator Klobuchar was elected in 2006, just this few months ago. Before that, of course, she was Hennepin County attorney from 1999 to 2006. At a university, we always like to talk about education, and she's got an undergraduate degree from Yale and her law degree from Chicago. What we're going to do is Senator Klobuchar is going to come up and talk on the theme of the heat is on, time for action on global warming. Then we'll sit down and start a conversation, and then we'll broaden it out to all of you. So be thinking about questions that you'll want to write down and pass forward. Without further ado, it's my great pleasure to introduce Senator Amy Klobuchar.
Thank you. Thank you. What a great crowd. Thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you, Larry. And I'm honored to be here with all of you at the Humphrey Institute to kick off the Connecting with Government series. And thank you, Professor Jacobs, for your leadership and all you've done to promote public policy discussions in our state. It is great to be here, of course, at the Humphrey Institute with so many friends. As you know, the seat that I hold in the Senate was once occupied by Hubert Humphrey. And I mentioned this when I was here a few months ago, but a little known fact is that my wedding reception took place in the lobby out there. And as I said back then, as you leave, try to picture it as a romantic moment that it was, with the fuchsia bridesmaid dresses, the helium balloons, and the band. And what you most remember is, I'm so honored here to have former Secretary of State Joan Grove, former Vice President Walter Mondale, and my dad here. They were all there to witness the wedding. And what I most remember is my dad gave this very beautiful toast with the microphone, and then in an Iron Range style, he took the microphone and threw it down so that when the Vice President came up, it didn't work. So we all remember that fondly. Not quite as momentous at that occasion in my personal life. I also remember this, as I said, back in the summer, I gave a speech here on ethics reform during the course of the Senate campaign. And I'm pleased to tell you only, 6 months later that the Senate now has adopted the most sweeping ethics reform we've had since Watergate, with Minnesota-style bans on gifts and meals and all kinds of things. And I'm very proud of the work that I did and the freshman class did in getting that through. I will say that things have been going well in Washington. I'm proud of the work we're doing. I'm a deputy whip already. We've pushed through that ethics legislation, the minimum wage increase, the 9/11 recommendations. We finally got enough votes to at least begin the process of with the war resolution process. It's been very difficult and challenging and will continue to be so, but I am proud of the work that we've done to not sit on our hands and push that debate. The other adjustment that I've had, of course, is getting used to Washington. My first lunch was rather memorable. It was in the fancy room, and we had all the senators there, and we had just elected Harry Reid as majority leader, and I went over and got a salad and a cup of soup, and I brought it back to the table, and I'm ready to dive in with my soup spoon. There's eight senators at the table, and all of a sudden, Senator Patty Murray from Washington grabs my arm, and she says, "Amy, you're about to eat the Thousand Island dressing." And I realized I had taken the entire bowl of Thousand Island dressing to the table. Someone later told me I should have said, "That's what we do in Minnesota. We eat the Thousand Island dressing." My husband has made adjustments. He's a proud member of the spouse group of the Senate. This is quite a group. I think he's the only man to consistently go to the meetings. And about a month ago, I was actually with Senator Claire McCaskill in a car. We were going somewhere, and all of a sudden, we see my husband walking across the Capitol lawn with a baby present. And we rolled down the window. We said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm going to Jim Webb's wife's baby shower." And so this is a first in the United States Senate. My daughter is making the adjustment. We have a 1,000-square-foot apartment that we live in, and we always like the reaction of Minnesotans when they come to visit. They always go, "Oh, this is nice," when they come in. But her favorite activity is taking visitors to the trash chute room. She took Senator John Tester and his wife there about a few weeks ago. We had them over for brunch, and she puts the trash down the chute and listens to it go down all 19th floor. And then she always says, "If you listen really carefully, sometimes people on the 10th floor put the trash in, and our trash hits their trash." She goes, "It's like we're in a club." My husband calls it the least exclusive club in America. So we are doing well in adjusting. And my committees are going great. I'm on the Commerce Committee, Environment Committee, the Joint Economic Committee, as well as the Agriculture Committee. And they're very focused on the work that we need to do for Minnesota, which is what I wanted to do. And that's why I'm honored to be here with all of you this afternoon. And we could really pick any topic for this series, but I thought it was very important to focus on the issue of climate change and the issue of homegrown energy and what we can do here for Minnesota's economy, with Minnesota leading the way. I truly believe in my heart that these ideas for solving climate change and for leading the way with the homegrown economy is going to create more jobs, it's going to make us more free and secure, and it will also preserve our country's preeminent role as the world's leader in ideas and innovation. I'm here to talk about solutions and opportunities. Global warming is currently presenting us with a world of dangers and risks, but it also gives us a universe of opportunities. I'm an optimist. I believe in science. And we're in a state here that gave the world the post-it note and the pacemaker. Our state has always been on the front of the line when it comes to science, and the university here has helped us to be up there right up front. I believe that technology and innovation will be the key to solving our climate and energy problems. And in solving these problems, we have the opportunity to develop revolutionary new technologies and create whole new industries. Here in the United States, we have the science, we have the universities, we have the technological know-how, and we have the financial capital. And in Minnesota, we have the fields to grow the fuel that will keep our nation moving. And we have the wind energy to propel our economy forward. So I believe the challenge of global warming is matched by the potential for positive change. Someone who has done much to spread this message is former Vice President Al Gore. 2 weeks ago, and maybe some of you heard this, he testified before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, of which I am fortunate to serve. It was a special occasion. We don't usually have former vice presidents, much less Academy Award winners, testifying before this particular committee. More often, it's someone who has gotten an award from a worthy but not very glamorous organization like the American Society of Civil Engineers. But there was also a difference in this hearing because in the past, when this committee had talked about global warming, they debated whether it existed. And this time, we were talking about solutions. There's no better reminder of this change than for those of you who watched or listened to the hearing than the memorable exchange between Senator Inhofe, the previous committee chair, and Barbara Boxer, who currently chairs it. At one point, he was badgering Gore so that he couldn't really answer any questions. And Boxer finally held up the gavel. She said, "You no longer have this gavel." She said, "I do. Elections have consequences." Well, elections do have consequences, and we are going to act, and we must act now. There is now an irresistible scientific consensus that the Earth is warming. Study after study demonstrates that global warming is real and that it is affecting us now. In early February, the authoritative Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued its latest report on the science of climate change. This report was produced by some 600 scientists from 40 countries. Over 620 experts reviewed it, and a large number of governmental reviewers also participated. This is a cautious group of scientists with a very conservative process for meticulously reviewing their evidence and reaching conclusions through consensus. And what did they conclude? Well, they concluded that changes in climate are now affecting physical and biological systems on every continent. A second study by this group will be officially released later this week on the visible and predicted effects of global warming, including shifting rain patterns, droughts, rising sea levels, melting glaciers, damaged ecosystems, and the spread of diseases. Early reports indicate that the study will find that coastlines around the world are already showing the impact of rising sea levels, and that by 2080, 100 million people each year could be flooded by rising seas. So how did this come about? Well, certain types of gases, most notably carbon dioxide, but also methane and nitrous oxide, accumulate in the atmosphere and then absorb or trap the sun's heat as it bounces off the Earth's surface. Carbon dioxide, the most infamous of the greenhouse gases, is produced in huge quantities by power plants, cars, manufacturing, and by residential and commercial building components. The problem is that carbon dioxide doesn't dissipate quickly. It stays in the atmosphere. For 5 decades or more, it stays in the atmosphere, causing Earth's temperatures to rise. This means that most of the carbon dioxide produced in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s are still in our atmosphere today. And it means that carbon dioxide produced today will still be in the atmosphere from the year 2050 and beyond. All that carbon dioxide has been trapping heat in the atmosphere. Over time, it means global temperatures rise. In turn, sea levels rise, both because the water expands as the oceans warm and because melting glaciers and ice caps add more water. Global warming is on the rise with enormous consequences for our world and our economy. 2006 was the hottest year ever in this country, capping a 9-year streak unprecedented in the historical record. We recently learned that this winter was the warmest record on record worldwide. If you remember, December in Minnesota felt more like October. Worldwide, glaciers are melting. In fact, almost everything frozen on Earth is melting. A few weeks ago, it was reported that glaciers in the European Alps will be all but gone by the year 2050. Experts believe that within 25 years, there won't be a single glacier left in Glacier National Park. And I'm looking over at my dad, who's a great explorer on his own, and maybe hasn't reached the heights of Will Steger in terms of what he's seen. But he knows what I'm talking about in terms of the mountain climbing he's done and the effect you've seen on glaciers worldwide. Globally, sea levels have risen 4 to 10 inches over this past century. And the frequency of extremely heavy rainfalls has increased throughout much of the United States. The impact is especially dire in Greenland and the Arctic region. The temperature changes there have been the greatest, resulting in widespread melting of glaciers, thinning of the polar ice cap, and rising permafrost temperatures. 20% of the polar ice cap has melted since 1979, and that's a figure that came from NASA. Other changes, like the recent increase in the severity of hurricanes and other extreme or destructive weather events, are consistent with the kinds of changes scientists expect to occur on a warming planet. And here I'm talking about the economic changes. There are early indicators of even more dramatic climate shifts and economic damages that await us if we don't reduce greenhouse gas emissions. As you can see from this slide here, over the past 10 years, weather-related economic damages have increased by over $200 billion worldwide. The prospect of what this brings us in the future, both for our environment, for our security, and for our economy, is what brings us here today. In Minnesota, we've always loved the outdoors, and we take pride in the richness and beauty of our natural resources. We protect our forests and our prairies, our lakes and our rivers, our diverse wildlife, and abundant farmland. In Minnesota, stewardship for the environment is a part of our heritage. It is also an important part of our economy. So global warming is an issue that strikes us close to home. And the people in our state are growing ever more concerned. I've heard this from everyone. You know, I've heard it from ice fishermen, from snowmobilers, and cross-country skiers who told me they personally observed the signs of global warming here in Minnesota. Do these two look happy about global warming? And Professor Jacobs, is this the first time that the grumpy old men slide was used at the Humphrey Institute? Okay, well, here we have. They're out. They're not happy about it. I've told people in Washington that there are hunters in Hibbing who care about this issue is because they've seen the changes in our wetlands. There's a couple out on Leech Lake who care about this issue because they've seen how much longer it takes for the lake ice to freeze so they can take their fish house and put it out on the lake. There's a city council in Lanesboro that has decided to switch to low energy light bulbs because they can see the effects of global warming. And this is an issue that has finally moved out of the science labs and the seminar rooms of this university. It has entered into the everyday conversations of people from all walks of life. It's real people in the real world talking about real changes that have them worried about is what is happening to our world and what the consequences will be for ourselves and for their kids and for their grandkids. The tide is turning. After years of inaction in Washington, I truly believe that Congress is finally being spurred to action. Why? Well, first, there's this outpouring of public support for change. 2 weeks ago, there was a very important rally on Capitol Hill as a demonstration of public concern and demand for serious action to address climate change. Coming up on April 14th is the Global Warming Day of Action with events across the country, including on the State Capitol Mall in St. Paul. This isn't just about 8-year-olds crying about penguins anymore. This is about people from all walks of life rising up and saying we need to do something about this. Second, business leaders are stepping forward and demanding action. 2 weeks ago, a group of the world's leading investors, asset managers, and companies issued a climate policy call to action, seeking tangible action by Congress to tackle global warming. There were some of the world's largest institutional investors managing over $4 trillion in assets. And if you want to see something unprecedented, earlier last month, the leaders of General Motors, Ford, Toyota, and Chrysler, along with the head of the United Auto Workers, made a rare joint appearance at a congressional hearing. All pledged to support mandatory caps on carbon emissions as long as they covered all sectors of the economy. And in January, My committee heard from the chief executive of many major corporations, including BP, DuPont, and PG&E. They have called for a call to action from corporate America. They seek a mandatory market-driven approach to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, an approach they believe will drive the development for new greener technology and become an engine for new economic growth and job creation. Third, new leadership in the fight against global warming has been coming from state and local governments across the country. Minnesota is a leader in this effort, with February's passage of a new law that is considered the nation's most aggressive standard for promoting renewable energy in electricity production. It's a 25 by 25 standard. By the year 2025, the state's energy companies are required to generate 25% of their electricity from renewable sources such as wind, water, solar, and biomass. The standard is even higher for the state's largest utility, Xcel, which must reach 30% by 2020. Almost as important as the renewable energy standard itself is the bipartisan political energy that supported this law. I was proud to tell the committee, including Senator Inhofe, that in Minnesota, this was adopted with overwhelming bipartisan support. The vote was 123-10 in the State House and 61-4 in the State Senate, and it was signed into law by Governor Tim Pawlenty. We're seeing other effects all around the country. Governors from five western states, including California and Arizona, have announced that they will work together to reduce greenhouse gases by setting regional targets for lower emissions and establishing a regional cap and trade system for buying and selling greenhouse gas credits. This new regional project builds on the work that has already been done in California. There's also the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement. More than 400 mayors representing over 59 million Americans have pledged to meet or beat the Kyoto Protocol greenhouse gas reduction gases goals in their own communities. Among the signatories to this agreement are the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Duluth. I admire these states and these communities for their initiative. But there is a famous phrase you've probably heard about the laboratories of democracy. That's how Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis described the special role of states in our federal system. In this model, states are where new ideas can emerge, where policymakers can experiment, where innovative proposals can be tested. Brandeis wrote over 70 years ago, "It's one of the happy incidences of the federal system that a single courageous state may, if its citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments without risk to the rest of the country." But he did not mean for this to serve as an excuse for inaction by the national government. Good ideas and successful innovations are supposed to emerge from the laboratory and serve as a model for national policy and action. That is now our responsibility in Congress. The courage we're seeing in the states as they deal with climate change should be matched by the courage in Washington. We should be prepared to act on a national level, especially when the states and local communities are showing us the way. With the public, the business community, and the state and local governments leading the way, things have to change in Washington. After years of congressional inaction, neglect, and even defiance on this issue, I believe we are finally seeing change. Every day, Congress makes decisions that have a great impact on the American people and the people throughout the world. But our decisions on global warming may well be the ones that have the most profound impact on our generation and on the very fate of the earth. The science is clear about what we need to do. We need to reduce greenhouse gases. It's not too late to act, but we have to act now. Here's what I think needs to be done. First, we need to establish economy-wide limits on greenhouse gas emissions with a cap and trade system that allows companies to adapt to these limits in the most efficient and least costly way. Second, to enable this cap and trade system to actually work, we need to establish a national reporting system to identify and measure all the sources of greenhouse gas emissions. I like to think of this as a carbon counter. Third, we need to embrace energy efficiency and conservation efforts across the board. Fourth, We need to promote greater fuel efficiency and the use of renewable fuels with our vehicles. Fifth, we need to adopt renewable energy standards like we've done in Minnesota so we can accelerate the transition from carbon-polluting energy sources. Sixth, we need to harness the enormous potential of our agriculture sector to develop renewable energy. And finally, we need to stand up and be a responsible international leader again. I'm going to briefly go through each of these. Some of these proposals are going to be familiar, and some of them probably won't be. And several of them are going to be a particular focus of my efforts in the Senate to get climate legislation passed. First, if the root of the problem is greenhouse gas emissions, principally carbon dioxide, then we have to stop putting so much of it in the atmosphere. The United States should establish mandatory science-based limits on carbon dioxide and other global warming pollutants so we can significantly reduce emissions from today's levels within 10 years. To make this work most effectively without disrupting our economy, we should establish a market-driven cap-and-trade system that provides economic incentives for reducing emissions. Under this system, the government sets a cap that limits emissions. The emissions allowed under this cap are then divided up into individual permits with the right to emit that amount of pollutants. Companies whose emissions exceed that allotment must buy or trade credits from other companies in order to cover that pollution. Companies that are able to reduce emissions at a low cost can sell their extra permits to companies facing high costs. A cap-and-trade system draws on the power of the marketplace to reduce emissions in a cost-effective and flexible manner. It creates a financial incentive for emission reductions by assigning an actual cost to pollution. It's an approach that was very successfully used to combat acid rain, and faster and cheaper when it combated acid rain than even the experts predicted. Second, to make a cap and trade system work, there needs to be full and accurate information about the sources and amounts of greenhouse gas pollution. Believe it or not, we just don't have that information right now. I've been involved in public policy long enough to know that you can't change or fix something unless you can accurately measure and monitor it. Right now, we don't have a system in place to fully identify and measure the sources of greenhouse gases. The EPA collects a lot of data on energy production and consumption. However, the quantity and the quality of the data varies across different fuels and different sectors. We need to have a consistent, high-quality data collection across all sectors, what I call a carbon counter system, if we're going to have an effective market for trading greenhouse gas credits. Third, we need to have stronger energy efficient and conservation efforts across the board. We can achieve significant reductions in global warming and pollution by improving the energy efficiency of our economy. Virtually every aspect of American life has the potential to be more energy efficient, often in ways that not only reduce greenhouse gases, but save money as well. Energy consumption in government buildings, private businesses, and homes accounts for almost two-thirds of CO2 emissions in America. An aggressive energy efficiency program could prevent a substantial amount of greenhouse gases going into the air. Last week, we had a hearing about this in front of the Environmental Committee as we're looking at creating stronger requirements for energy efficiency in government buildings. We heard testimony from officials who just put together a federal building in New York State, which is the first federal facility in the nation powered by 100% renewable energy. The power flows from a new wind turbine installed in the town of Fetter, New York. As you know, it's happening in Minnesota, too. We have so many wind turbines right now down in the Pipestone area and in southeastern Minnesota that they've actually opened up a bed and breakfast down there. And so if you're looking for a romantic weekend, Larry, you can just go down there, you stay overnight in the bed and the breakfast, and then you wake up in the morning and look at the wind turbine. That's the package. In St. Paul, as well, the Public Housing Agency, which has a 14-story office building, was built to use 50% less energy than required by code. The building's electric bill was cut in half thanks to simple measures like orienting the building along an east-west axis, which reduces heating and cooling demands, and using dimmable controls on the light fixtures. And the best part is that it costs just 2% more than conventional construction, a cost that was paid for after less than 2 years thanks to reduced energy consumption. And in the end, it will obviously save us money. These projects not only demonstrate a commitment to energy independence and environmental stewardship, but also help spur economic growth. Energy conservation also means individual action. Just look at Time Magazine's cover story just this week. I picked it up in the airport, titled The Global Warming Survival Guide, 51 Things We Can Do. And consider this. If every American home replaced just one traditional light bulb with an energy-efficient fluorescent light bulb, the energy savings would be enough to light more than 2.5 million homes for a year, and it would prevent greenhouse gases equivalent to nearly 800,000 cars. Fourth, we need to promote energy-efficient standards in our transportation sector. The creation of federal fuel economy standards for cars during the 1970s succeeded in reducing gasoline consumption and oil imports, as well as global warming pollution. Were you part of that, Vice President Mondale? I just guessed that. But the fuel economy of the new vehicles is now lower than it was during most of the Reagan administration. All types of vehicles can be designed to be far more energy efficient, and most of the improvements in fuel economy can actually save money for consumers over the long term, especially with gas prices again approaching nearly $3 a gallon. Hybrid cars are becoming more popular and more efficient. The old version required you to plug in your car and carry around the extra batteries. It's getting better and better, and for the first time, we actually have a waiting list for hybrid vehicles. We also need to replace, of course, our fuel that we use and trend more and more toward using biofuels. I'm proud to be talking about cellulosic ethanol, and I'm going to talk about that when we discuss the agriculture piece of this, which is the next step of ethanol, which is carbon neutral. Fifth, I believe we have to set a national renewable energy portfolio standard that sets tangible, measurable goals and targets for using renewable energy in the production of electricity and fuel. As I mentioned, Minnesota's already leading the way, and I believe that Minnesota's example can help show us the way to a national renewable portfolio standard for electricity production. America has virtually limitless potential for the generation of power from natural forces like wind, solar, geothermal, and biomass energy. You know, when my daughter and I, one of the things that I learn when I get out there is there's always attacks from the other side that this is going to somehow hurt our economy. And in fact, there are standards and tests out there and studies showing that, in fact, it can help our economy as we move from investing in the oil cartels of the Midwest, in the Mideast, and instead are investing in the farmers and the workers of the Midwest. And my daughter did a project for this last year for her class on new biofuels, and she drew a big map of the state of Minnesota. And she had interviewed a farmer named Tom Peterson about the work that's going on with biofuels. And on this map, she had drawn this big circle, and it said, Pine City, home of farmer Tom Peterson. And then there were these two little dots that said, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And it brought home to me how much this can mean for our rural economy with jobs and driving the economy of our state. And we have to remember this as we look at the biofuel industry. This brings us to another area that holds great potential. Our agriculture sector is already at the forefront of developing clean, renewable energy sources. And I want agriculture's role in fighting climate change to be a focus of the Farm Bill, which Congress is writing this year. With forward-looking farming practices, America's heartland holds great promise for homegrown solutions to global warming. I serve on that committee, which is chaired by our good neighbor to the South, Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa. As you know, Colin Peterson of Minnesota is chairing the committee in the House. I've been taking a lead on introducing legislation that would offer incentives to farmers to produce a new generation of energy crops suitable for cellulosic ethanol production. In Minnesota, we've been pioneers in the corn and biodiesel soybean ethanol for gasoline. During the past 25 years, ethanol has proven to be one of the great success stories in the Minnesota economy. Corn and soybeans are the backbone of the biofuels revolution in this country. This energy revolution is advancing rapidly, and the University of Minnesota has been at the forefront. There is now exciting research coming out of the university, led by Regents Professor David Tillman and Dr. Jason Hill, that highlights the energy potential of native grasses like switchgrass. Their research shows that perennial grasses grown on marginal farmland can produce as much new or net energy per acre as corn and soybeans. And when you compare the energy balance, the amount of energy in the fuel, compared to the amount of energy that was used to convert the crop into the fuel, prairie grasses have a much higher energy balance than traditional biofuels. These energy crops can also hold great promise for farmers because they can grow on marginal land that can't produce the high yield of corn or soybeans, and they restore the land while they're growing. Native grasses can also save farmers money on fuel and other inputs because they don't require lots of passes with farm equipment or heavy fertilizer applications. Nearly three decades ago, Congress made an investment in ethanol and biodiesel that has really paid off. Now it's time for Congress to build on this success and invest in the next generation of homegrown energy, which is cellulosic biofuels. This will not only be good for our ethanol industry here in Minnesota, but these grasses also provide habitat for ground nesting birds and other wildlife, so it's going to be good for our conservation efforts. I've suggested that the incentives for this effort would go to farmers through the CSP or Conservation Security Program, which would be expanded to allow for greater enrollments. I always think of ethanol and soy and biodiesel as kind of the beginning of the computer age when we had those big computers in those big rooms. And now as we expand our technology and our knowledge, we're going to be advancing to more and more technology and to greater opportunities for our economy and our environment. Finally, we need to be an international leader again. The United States can and must lead, but we cannot solve the problem by ourselves. All countries must participate in a global solution to a global problem. China, India, Brazil, and other economies must be weaned away from fossil fuels. But what is their incentive to do this if the United States won't? Last week, I co-sponsored a resolution that calls for the United States to return to a leadership role in international climate change negotiations. The resolution recognizes that there are real economic benefits in both from reducing the waste and inefficiencies inherent in greenhouse gas emissions and from developing new climate-friendly technologies. As other nations address climate change, they also reap the economic benefits from new technological innovations. Does the United States want to be a leader in creating the new green technologies and the new green industry? Are we going to sit back and watch the opportunity pass as other countries do it? I want us to be a leader. In conclusion, just as there is no single industry or source that is responsible for greenhouse gas emissions, there is no single policy or technology that will solve global warming. That is why we need a comprehensive approach with many solutions. Instead of a silver bullet, we need a silver buckshot. As I mentioned at the beginning, my Senate seat used to be held by Hubert Humphrey. He was, of course, a man of many words. But there is one quote of his that I hold especially dear. It is inscribed on his gravestone at Lakewood Cemetery in Minneapolis. It says, "I have loved my country in a way that some people consider sentimental and out of style. I still do. And I remain an optimist with joy, without apology, about this country and about this American experiment in democracy." Like Hubert and like most Americans, I am an optimist too. I believe in the power and the promise of science and technology and innovation when we need to solve a problem. I believe in the capacity of our democratic system of government to make the right decisions for the good of our country. And I believe in the intelligence and the ingenuity of the American people when we are confronted with a challenge. We have plenty of that intelligence and ingenuity right here in Minnesota. That's why I'm establishing a new awards program to recognize efforts by local governments, businesses, and students in Minnesota to reduce global warming. Now, you're laughing at our slide here showing the super carbon buster. But that's what we're doing. You see, this isn't just a touchy-feely topic anymore. This is like big guys do this. That's why we're establishing this new awards program, and I'm going to call it the Carbon Buster Awards. We have a one-page handout here that tells more about it. We each have a role, and we're going to be rewarding government, business, schools who participate in this and come up with ideas and actually walk the talk and bust carbons and help us to combat global warming. That's to acknowledge that we each have a role, and there's plenty for all of us to do. And if we work together, we can turn the corner on the devastating effects of climate change, and we can take giant strides toward a new future that is fueled by renewable energy. We know it can be done because it's already starting right here in Minnesota and right here on this campus. With forward-looking leadership from Washington, we can move ahead to build this new future even more quickly and with even greater determination. And I think we can all look forward to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ellen Tveit is walking around collecting questions along with Lisa. So if you've got questions, pass them to the aisle. We'll get to them. Senator Klobuchar, that was an energetic and stimulating talk.
Not that many people fell asleep, Larry. It was pretty good.
I can't remember a talk on science and technology that was as stimulating as that. And it's really striking as you look at the presidential race, which is already setting records in terms of fundraising, but also is moving into high gear. The front runners, from John McCain over to the Democratic side with Hillary Clinton and John Edwards, all making global climate change one of their top issues. Why is it that now? What is it about now that has made this such a hot topic?
I think it's because regular people are starting to notice this. They looked at the scientific reports and they sort of thought, well, I don't know what's true, what's not true. But I think that the overwhelming scientific evidence is there. But what's changed is that regular people are starting to see the effects of this. I wasn't kidding when I said that I went and spoke to a group of 200 people that were interested in hunting and interested in wetlands. And I remember I made a joke at the beginning about how it was like 70 below zero wind chill on that particular day, and I couldn't believe they all came out to talk about climate change, and no one laughed. And I think that was because they actually have seen firsthand the effects that in the long range this is having on their lives and on the lives of the people in Minnesota. And everywhere I went during the last week when I went around the state in southern Minnesota, I was talking about elder care, I was talking about middle class tax cuts, I was talking about the war, but at not one event did I go to where someone didn't ask about climate change. And I think people are looking at things that are bigger than themselves, that this is a very serious time in our country. You saw it in the last election where people were evaluating candidates not necessarily on their personalities, they were also looking at where they stood on the issues. Incredible number of people were watching the debates, I know, in our race. So something like nearly 25% of them watched Meet the Press. And I think what that signifies is a shift in the American interest in what's going on and an understanding of the long term, which I think is very good for this country. And this basically started, as I said, with kids crying about penguins, and it went to college kids. And basically, the people have led the way on this issue, and the elected officials are finally catching up.
Thank you. On this issue and the way you framed it and the way you've been moving in Washington, it's a win-win issue. It's an issue that addresses the environment, contributes to conservation, and also presents some real economic opportunity. So you've got the national head of the Corn Growers Association, very supportive of some of the policies you've been pursuing. But I'm wondering, as you look around the country and its representatives in Washington, clearly there are costs to some of these policies, and in different parts of the region, different parts of the country, there are certain regions that are going to be hit even harder. So Virginia and West Virginia, for instance, and Senator Byrd is one name that comes to mind. Or if you go out to Michigan, you've got Congressman Dingell, who's very concerned about some of these consequences. What are your thoughts about how we should think about the costs of some of the proposals you're looking at that are being discussed in Washington?
Well, first of all, you have to balance the costs of these proposals against the costs of inaction. And there have been reports, and we showed that slide, showing dramatic effects to our economy if we do nothing. And that's why I think you have these major CEOs coming together, companies like DuPont and BP, who've listened to their own scientists and said, we just can't do nothing, that we're going to have major economy-wide negative effects if we just let keep this going the way it's going. So that's the first thing to look at. The second thing to look at is how we do this. You know, I sat with the CEO of Xcel. He came to my office, and he said they're going to be able to make that 30% standard of renewables basically without affecting rates. He said it's not going to be easy, but we're going to be able to do it. Well, if that company can do it, why can't other companies do it across the country? So I think we have to look at leading examples of business people who are willing to go forward like that. The next piece of this is that we actually will save money with some of these proposals. DuPont saved $2 billion by reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. So you have to measure some of the negative effects against the positive effects. And I believe in the end, by reducing our dependency on foreign oil, it's going to have a net positive for our country. So you need to look at this globally and remember that if we just keep going the way we're going, it's going to have major, major effects on our economy. We've got to do it smart. That's why I support the cap and trade idea, which worked so well with acid rain. We have to do it economy-wide so that one sector isn't signaled out. That's why you had the auto industry saying, okay, we'll do this, but you've got to do it in the rest of the economy as well. And you have to work with those individual states that are confronted by the biggest difficulties to make sure that we don't do anything that's completely disruptive overnight. That's why the CAFE standards, we have to go up gradually and figure out where they should be. But I think there's a way to do this. I mean, we are a country that put a man on the moon when we decided to do that. There is no reason that we shouldn't be able to come together and solve this in a bipartisan way.
Thank you. You talked about the need to move away from the silver bullet approach of there's one solution to looking at a comprehensive set of solutions. And some of the catchwords that you hear a lot in this debate are energy mix, balance. I'm just wondering kind of some of the different components of that mix that you didn't quite get to we could talk about, including coal, which really is an example of something that's very important to the economy of West Virginia, to Virginia, and is a very important source of cheap electricity. About half of our electricity comes from coal, of course, but it also has enormous environmental damage. Would you be interested, or what are your views about reducing coal use?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to start using new technology for coal. And you've seen just very recently a major business agreement for some coal plants in Texas in which they agreed to use clean coal technology. And so the idea is to, as we move forward, is to transition to this clean coal technology, which is much better for our environment than some of the old coal plants, and to go that way. I mean, we have to acknowledge we're not going to get rid of coal here. We have to look at how we do coal better. The other piece of this is shifting more and more to renewable standards by putting those portfolio standards in place like we've done in Minnesota, building the wind transmission lines and creating those market incentives so we can export our wind across this country, being smart about how we do that. And then I think finally, it's the individual conservation measures that are going to make an enormous difference. I use that example of just one light bulb in every home could light 2.5 million homes across this country if we switch the light bulb. So people who I think already are engaged in this, just like they were in the 70s about making shifts in how we handle the environment, have to come to the forefront. So again, we have to be smart about how we do coal. We have to look at everything as possibilities. We have to look at nuclear again. I think that if we do that, we have to make sure we have safe places to store nuclear waste and look at that in a very different way as they're doing in Europe. But we're going to have to be open to new technologies like we haven't been in the last few years. And that means clean coal, and that means putting in higher standards for renewables.
Great. Thank you very much. Oil. Chevron recently discovered a major new deposit of oil just off the coast of Louisiana. And there's been some discussion of lifting the 25-year moratorium on offshore oil and gas exploration. Again, as part of this comprehensive solution, do you see that as a possibility?
Well, actually, the Congress did pass a bill that allowed for some more oil exploration and how we shared the oil revenues with the Gulf states. And I did, that came out of the Senate, and I did support that. It was voted on before I got in there. I think that there are some things we can do, but I don't think that we can completely start drilling right next to the coastline. I was down in New Orleans with our committee to work with Senator Landrieu and Senator Vitter on some of these issues, not only with the levees, but the disappearing coastline in New Orleans, which actually contributed to the damage that was done with the flooding. So as we look at how we're going to allow for more oil exploration and natural gas exploration, we just have to be smart about it and make sure that what we're doing isn't really making it worse for our environmental situation in this country.
Thank you. Another potential part of the mix on energy, nuclear energy. About 20% of the country's electricity comes from nuclear power plants. Of course, this has been stalled for almost three decades in terms of expansion. What's your thinking about nuclear energy and its role in terms of future energy needs and meeting them?
Well, there is work going on worldwide, which is promising in terms of the new technologies and safer nuclear energy. And especially, I think we should be looking at some of the work that's going on in Europe. I'm not opposed to looking at nuclear energy as part of the solution. I think, again, that we need to look at waste disposal, which we have not been able to get our arms around in this country. We have the issue at Prairie Island in Minnesota and waste transportation. And if we can find our way to find a safe place for this nuclear waste, I think we should be open at looking at more nuclear.
Great. Thank you. What incentives do you propose in particular to encourage farmers to grow prairie grass for cellulosic ethanol?
And I talked about this briefly in my remarks. I'm taking the lead on the cellulosic ethanol issue. Lindsey Graham is working with me on it, as well as a number of other Republicans on the committee. And the idea here is to build on our corn and soybean ethanol and biodiesel to go to the next stage, which is cellulosic ethanol, which is carbon neutral. It's going to allow our farmers to grow switchgrass and prairie grass on marginal farmland, and I'm going up tonight to northwestern Minnesota, where you have all kinds of possibilities there for marginal farmland, and I think in other parts of the state as well, in other parts of the country. So the idea is the way you do it financially is Senator Harkin was one of the authors of the Conservation Security Program, or CSP program, where we reward farmers for farming techniques and innovations that are good for conservation. And so the idea would be to streamline and focus some of those funds on specifically on switchgrass and prairie grass, so we reward them for doing this. You can also do some of it with the CRP money. We're focused on the Conservation Security Program money. And we've had some issues with that program all over the country with farmers enrolling and that getting cut off. Very little of that money is going to Minnesota. And I think that we can really make some strides with this energy issue. And it also will bring in some support for some of our ag programs from other states that might not be as interested in ag. So that's a good thing as well, in addition to the bipartisan support. There's other things going on that are very exciting that I didn't get to. Like, I decided not to talk about turkey litter in my speech, but we're doing a lot with converting turkey litter, and that's a euphemism, and other animal waste to energy. And there's some groundbreaking work going on in Minnesota for that that I think should be rewarded as we go forward. We just have to step back and think of these things as in a way that we never did before as we look for sources of energy.
Thank you. You heralded action by states as laboratories of democracy. If Minnesota enacted a cap on carbon in cooperation with other states, would that help create pressure for federal action?
You know, I think that would be, as you look at what we did in Minnesota with the 30% standard, if we wanted to do that for Xcel, 25% for our other electricity companies. If we wanted to do that regionally, I think that would be a good thing. That's what they did in with Napolitano in Arizona, and some of the other Western governors did in the New Jersey area. On the East Coast, there's a group of states that have come together with some regional standards, and I think we should be doing that in the Midwest as well. I still think it's sad that with all this talk, the truth is, has Congress adopted one bill that actually puts in place a portfolio standard? The answer is no. Do we have a cap and trade standard in place nationally? No. And so there are those that argue, well, if the states keep doing this, it's going to be disruptive because it's different in all the states. And I there's some argument for that. And I say, go ahead and keep adopting these, because maybe finally there'll be so much pressure from businesses and others to say, we need national standards. We're not going to lessen the state standards, but we need some national standards as well. And so I'm a big fan of allowing states to act and be the laboratories of democracy, because I think that's the only way that we're finally going to get some action out of Washington.
Your discussion of transportation focused on improving fuel efficiency of vehicles. Is there also a role for trying to reduce dependence on private automobiles as opposed to other forms of transport, particularly mass transit?
You know, I do think we need more mass transit in this country. We had the head of Amtrak came and spoke to our committee, and that was interesting because they're finally seeing an increase in ridership and demand, especially on regional lines, and I think we need to promote more of those lines. We're seeing it in Minnesota with the North Star Rail. I just wrote a letter this week to the federal government about why aren't we yet. We've gotten the allocation, but we still haven't gotten some of that money there to get North Star in place. Anyone that's driven on 94 to St. Cloud knows what I'm talking about, that we need more of this. You've seen the success of the light rail in the Twin Cities, and I'm hoping that we can expand on that. So clearly the answer is not just more fuel-efficient vehicles, but also the availability of more mass transit across this country. And we've, especially in our state, it's been slow in coming. But I think when you see the gas prices where they are, people become more and more interested as it becomes more economical. I wish we'd have it in place already, because then our citizens could just be using it as opposed to having to build it right now. But we are where we are, and we just can't say, well, now we can't do it. I think and hope that it will spur investment in mass transit.
Here's a comment and a question. Satellite and balloon temperature measurements over the past 30 years have not shown any significant change in the long-term rate of increase in global temperatures. Average readings show a mild warming of between 0.6 to 0.8 Celsius over the last 100 years. No catastrophic warming has been recorded. What's your thoughts on these?
Is Senator Inhofe's son out there somewhere? No. Okay, well, let me answer that question. In fact, we have, and I knew I'd get this question, so I got the numbers down. We've seen a 1 degree rise in Fahrenheit in temperatures in the last century. Now you think, well, it doesn't sound that bad. Well, you have to remember, if you go back to the height of the Ice Age, we've only seen a 5 degree increase in temperature since that time. So a 1 degree increase in one century is significant. Not only that, the EPA is projecting a 3 to 8 degree increase in this century. So these temperature increases, while they may seem okay in Minnesota to go up 1 degree, it sounds kind of nice right now, they are significant worldwide. And you see with them the effects. You've seen a 4 to 10 inches, I mentioned, increase in the sea levels. You've seen melting of the polar ice caps. And what happens then, as the oceans are warming, when these hurricanes, the global warming doesn't create the hurricanes, but when the hurricanes come up across the oceans and the oceans are warmer, they go from a category 4 to a category 5. They simply get stronger and stronger. So that's what's happening. And you also see historically with the CO2 emissions, when they go up, the temperatures go up. You can trace that. You can see that in Al Gore's book. You can see it in other scientific sources where you see an increase in the CO2 levels. You see an increase in the temperatures. And we've been seeing that increase in the CO2 levels. I think it's about 100 parts per million higher in just this last century.
Thank you.
I was ready for that question, Larry.
Yes, clearly. There's a lot of discussion about biofuels. Obviously, for Minnesota, it's a win-win situation. We both contribute to the environment and contribute to our economy. But there are other concerns that have been raised in terms of possible competition it's going to put on the food supply. We've got a question here from someone who says that because of the demand, the growing demand for soybeans, Brazil is continuing to deforest the Amazon in order to grow more soybeans, therefore not only contributing to global warming, but also competing with Minnesota farmers. What will the U.S. do to both protect the rainforest and also support our own agriculture?
It's a good question. I know the Humphrey Institute is doing, the university is doing some kind of seminar on this in a few weeks that people should find out about. But first of all, I talked about the ethanol industry and how I see it as the big computer in the room right now. As we get more and more refined in our technology, we're going to get more and more energy efficient ethanol, and maybe it'll be other parts of corn, and as I've suggested, the cellulosic ethanol and the prairie grass as we move forward. I've heard from pork producers and from beef producers and others that rely on corn and soybeans for food for their animals, and certainly you're seeing across the world a rise in the corn prices. That being said, we need to go at this smartly and gradually. Corn prices have been down other times. Corn prices go up. I think it's important to keep a safety net in the farm bill because we don't know what's going to happen a few years from now or what the environmental effects will have. So I think the answer here is not to say, no, we're not going to do corn-based or soybean-based ethanol. That would not be the answer. The answer is to build on those and to move forward into the next stage. And I've really been struck by when I visited with Pheasants Forever and other conservation groups, when I visit with corn growers and soybean growers, when I visited with the pork producers, who I always recognize because they have the pig pins on their lapels, that people understand this, that they know that the pork's actually been doing pretty well in Minnesota. Their costs have gone up about 10% because of this increase in corn, but they understand we're not going to dismantle corn ethanol right now, that it's an important part of our economy. They also understand that we're going to be going to the next stage. And so many of our farmers have diversified. You have sugar beet farmers that are into corn. You have pork producers that are also see the other side of the energy revolution. So you have this really, I'd say, joint concern that we move about this, that we do it in the right way, but that we always just keep in mind that we want a strong Minnesota economy, but we want to preserve our way of life, which includes smart conservation measures. So that's why there's so much work going on at this university toward moving toward the next stage of ethanol and biofuels.
Thank you. Should overpopulation be recognized as a single important cause of global warming?
You know, I don't have all those exact numbers on that, but I mean, clearly there has been research that shows clearly one of the major causes for global warming have been what people have done. And I don't know that it's necessarily the number of people, and I'm sure that is a piece of it, but it's how we've run our lives. And you have countries like ours, which are so rich in possibility for new technology and development that have contributed in a large part to global warming. So I think that the answer is I believe that we should help other countries with population and birth control and things like that. I believe that the other piece of this answer is to be smarter about how we run our lives. And I'm not going to go through all of it again, but with our light bulbs and with inflating our tires and with the kind of buildings that we build and the kind of government cars that we drive and the kind of technology we develop for coal and other things. We just have to be smarter about this.
You're sitting here and we've got a really wonderful audience of students, faculty, and friends from the community. How could people here, students and faculty and folks in the community, help?
Well, I'd suggest first by participating on April 14th in the rally that they're having on the state capitol ground. Do we know the time it is? Does anyone know that?
Noon to 4.
Noon to 4. And I think having people come out and express themselves on this issue from noon to 4 next, is it on April 14th, would be very helpful. I think that kind of people listen, government policy, people listen to those kinds of rallies and people showing their strength. I think you also have to, you know, look at that Time magazine cover story and look at other sources on the internet about things you can individually do in your own lives. I think talking to young people about this and students is a big piece of this. I talked about my daughter's project she did last year. Well, this year she did a project on global warming, and she came home and she said, well, Mom, the presentation went really well, but there was a girl on the other side. Now, you have to remember when you're in the Virginia public schools, you wonder, I go, what's the last name of that girl? And it was a name I'd never heard of. I said, well, did she say global warming doesn't exist? She goes, no. Her proposal was about the good effects of global warming. I go, what? She goes, well, it'll open up the Bering Straits and there'll be more ocean and seafood for people to eat because more of our Earth will be covered by water. So my point of that story is that getting these discussions going on in school and with young people, I think, is very important in our schools. It's not saying you got to teach it one way. It's just getting the facts out there. And then finally, there's the all true contacting your local officials, contacting your Congress representatives as well as the senators about this issue and making your views known and really spurring them to action, because this is a year that we've got to get something done. We can't wait till the presidential election. On our committee, I'll tell you that Senator Lamar Alexander and Senator Warner, two Republicans, are supportive of getting something done. Senator Lieberman is on our committee, and he's been a leader in the cap and trade legislation in trying to get things done. The other Democrats on our committee are very hopeful and positive about getting things done. So we do have the votes there. Whether the ultimate legislation will be everything everyone in this room wants, I can't promise you that, but I think there's a strong consensus that we have to get something done soon.
Thank you. Just a couple last questions as we're running out of time here. Could you refer to some natural remedies for global warming, such as our forests that capture carbons?
You know, I talked here about switchgrass and clearly having to make sure that we're smart about conservation so that we have the Minnesota tradition with our forests and our plants and our land, that we preserve these things and that we're smart about our, how we do timber. And I've talked to the timber people about this as well. They understand this, and there's also actually possibilities for them with the residue from logging that can be used for biomass. So I just think overall, when you look at natural solutions, it's some of the good old-fashioned work that we've always known can be done in this country, and that means being smart about how we take care of our land.
Thank you. The last time you were here is before the election. You've been to Washington a little bit, so we can't help but wonder, who's the senator or senators who have most impressed you now that you're in this august assembly?
Well, first of all, I would say the senator, individual senator that most surprised me actually has been Ted Kennedy, because I don't know what I thought. I just thought of him as someone giving speeches and everything. But he sort of symbolizes something that goes on in the Senate that I think Vice President Mondo knows about. And that's that there's these people that have never lost their passion for what they're doing. And he'll stand up in our caucus meetings where, you know, people could be talking about things like poll results for all we know. This is just for the Democratic caucus. And he will just give a passionate pitch for something that he cares deeply about and remind us about why we're here. I also have seen in him this amazing ability to work across the aisle with the Republicans on things. I think something that people didn't expect. And certainly one of my most fun moments in the Senate was when I was presiding and I got to gavel Ted Kennedy to order. The other thing I'd add, just as a bigger thing, is just that there is a lot more, you've probably heard this before, civility in the Senate than maybe in the other House, and also the people genuinely get to know each other and like each other. And I'd say the Republicans, a group, have been very good to me. I've gotten to know a lot of them. It's going to help me in moving things forward. Some of it is the way the votes work there. You got to get 60 votes practically to get things done, so the system forces you to work across the aisle. So I am, like everyone, frustrated with this administration. I shouldn't say everyone. I'm sure we have some conservative bloggers in the front row here. I am been frustrated with this administration. I disagree with a lot of what they're doing. And what I'm hoping for in some of these Republicans who are starting to sound out, like Chuck Hagel and Warner, about the war, that we're going to see that across the board on some other issues as well, that they're going to come to the forefront. If that doesn't happen, we will just keep adding Democrats, and we will get there when we have 60 votes, and we'll get everything done.
Senator Klobuchar, thank you very much for coming and spending the noon hour with us. And to all of you who have come, thank you. Have a good day.
Well, thank you. Thanks, everybody.